It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
From the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., backed by the trusted voices of Team Fox. Team Fox. A clear, fresh voice cutting through the noise to tell the truth. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It is Monday, April 29th, 2024, a brand new broadcast week. Underway here on the Guy Benson Show. I'm Guy Benson, political editor at townhall.com and a Fox News contributor, host of this program between 3 and 6 p.m. Eastern every weekday and then around the clock for free on our podcast. No charge. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. I spent the weekend in dreary, rainy Oregon in the Pacific Northwest. Had a great time at the event, but the weather was very on brand for that neck of the woods, and then flew to South Carolina yesterday, and I am in Charleston, South Carolina for the next couple of days. And when I tell you the weather here is glorious, it is glorious. In fact, Adam is up on the rooftop right now. I think there's a pool here somewhere. And I, however, am focused on the task at hand, on the job. Over these next 3 hours, we have a fantastic show for you, and I hope you'll stay tuned for all of it. Eli Lake is going to be here later on this hour. U.S. Senator Steve Daines of Montana will join us in the next hour. He is also NRSC chairman this cycle, meaning that is the group, that is the Republican Party entity responsible for electing Republican senators. The map is very favorable for Republicans, at least in theory, this year. How is Chairman Daines, Senator Daines, feeling about a whole slew of races? We will go down the list with him coming up. Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, retired, also will be here talking about Israel, talking about Ukraine. Looking forward to that conversation. Then Joe Concha listened to President Biden do an interview with Howard Stern. I mean, to call that a suck-up interview is an understatement. We'll discuss it with Joe. Plus, he watched the White House Correspondents' Dinner, so you didn't have to. I missed it completely. As I said, I was out of town and more than happy to be many, many miles away from really one of the swampiest events in swamp culture. I'll go occasionally. I'll go to the parties, but I was not shedding tears to have missed out on the festivities this year, and it was extra nauseating in certain ways. We'll explain with Joe Concha in our final hour. As we begin today's show, I do want to open by offering this thought. It's almost a lamentation, an effort to have all of us put aside what might be our differences and try to feel some empathy for the journalists at CNN, because they're probably having a difficult day. They were having, for the most part, I would imagine, a fabulous weekend, right? Friday night, all these parties in D.C., the booze is flowing, it's the White House Correspondents' Dinner, it's time to congratulate themselves for being facts matter, facts first, whatever. This is an apple, a banana's a banana. Truth firefighters, whatever the current term that they're using to describe their important work as journalists. Now, remember, there are no opinion hosts at CNN. This is what they tell us. Only news. Only news anchors. So they'd spent the whole week covering the trial of the century for the second week in a row. Donald Trump as a criminal defendant. A dream come true. It's like Christmas morning every day. And they've been wall to wall. Same with that other cable news network that cannot get enough of the trial. And you think about it, for really the last couple of years, CNN and some of these other places, it's just been very dyspeptic. There's no Trump. The orange man is out of office. And leaving office with him almost was the will to live for some of these people. You know, just sapped of all passion and meaning in life. But now he's back. He's back in a courtroom of all places. It's a dream come true. So that's day after day, last week, culminating in the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where they got to get together and slap each other on the back and just celebrate the very special elite class that is journos in the United States of America. So why should we feel empathy? Why should we feel sad at all for them? Well, on Sunday morning, perhaps slightly groggy, dare I say hungover in some cases, they might have grabbed their phones immediately upon waking up to check if there is any overnight news breaking about Donald Trump. And to their horror, they might have seen the results of their new poll. This is CNN's own pollster dropping new numbers on Sunday morning, and just the crestfallen reaction of some of these journos. You know, it's enough to bring a tear to your eye, perhaps, or a twinkle. They probably put their phones right back down, thought it was a bad dream, and went back to sleep. But no, it's real. This is the latest CNN poll. Trump 49, Biden 43. Trump is up 6 points in this poll. It is the largest lead Trump has ever had in the history of the CNN poll. Imagine just the gall, how rude it is for the CNN poll to ruin the weekend of CNN. Probably didn't see that coming. Trump plus 6 nationally among registered voters. Well, what about if there's an expanded field? What if you get RFK Jr. in there? What if you get Cornel West and Jill Stein? Well, in a 5-person field, Trump's margin increases to a 9-point lead. Trump 42, Biden 33, and the others combining for 23. Now, let me just add, before I delve more into these numbers, it's one poll, and we're, what, 6 months away from the election? So this is not determinative. It is not necessarily predictive. So many things will happen between now and then. But these numbers come on the heels of Donald Trump being on trial. This poll was taken during the early stages of this trial with saturation coverage, especially on a place like CNN. And Trump's lead has expanded to the biggest it has ever been in the CNN poll series history. And I just saw another one flash across maybe an hour or two ago. Harvard-Harris has Trump up by 4 nationally in a brand new poll. Monmouth has a new poll out with Trump leading nationally. So at least for now, early going, criminal trial number 1, not only is it not hurting Trump, at least at the moment, it appears that he might be benefiting slightly. Now, when you look at this CNN number, with all the caveats in place, I think this is such a crucial data point. They asked the American people, they asked voters, this is actually U.S. adults, do you believe overall Donald Trump's presidency was a success or a failure? Then they asked the same thing about Biden, success or failure of a presidency. Of the current incumbent, Joe Biden, 39% say on balance it's a success. 61% say Joe Biden's presidency has been a failure. So he's underwater by 22 points on that question, Biden is. And not coincidentally, his approval rating is almost exactly the same, underwater by 20 points. In this CNN poll. So people are living through the Biden presidency. The Biden people and the media and the late night TV hosts, everyone's out there telling them, you ingrates, don't you understand? Things are going well in this country. Why are people so negative about Joe Biden? Well, they have very good reasons, which is why his approval rating is 20 points underwater and why the American people in the CNN poll say that Biden, by a 22-point margin, has been a failure of a president. Now, what about Trump? And you look at these numbers, a lot of people disapprove of Donald Trump and view him unfavorably. A large majority, actually, a sizable majority within this electorate, within this group of respondents, give Trump very low marks on personal favorability, but that's not the same question as, was his presidency a success or a failure? Wasn't that long ago, people kind of looking back, a little bit of retrospect, especially given what came next with this crew. 55% of poll respondents said that Donald Trump had a successful presidency. 44% said it was a failure. So Biden is at 39-61 minus 22. Trump is at 55-44 plus 11. You do that math, that is a 33-point gap separating perceptions of the success or failure of these two men's presidency. Trump on the positive end of that 33-point gap, which probably explains why he is up 6 to 9 points overall in the poll. A few more numbers here. His approval rating, Biden's overall, 40%. On the economy, it is 34%. Bidenomics. By the way, this poll was in the field before we got the bad GDP number, before we got a reminder of the bad inflation numbers and worries about stagflation, before people really started talking about the possibility of big tax increases if Trump's tax cuts are allowed to expire, which Biden, at least in a tweet, said he wanted. So they've been gaslighting us about the economy, trying to convince us everything's actually pretty good and we should be happy about it. 34% approval in the CNN poll for Joe Biden on the economy. On the inflation issue, specifically, right, within the broader economic context, his approval rating is 29%. I'd love to meet those 29%, but still, that is an atrocious number. 29% approval on inflation. Listen to this. 65% of registered voters in the CNN poll call the economy extremely important to their vote for president. So that would be two-thirds. Two-thirds of these Americans in the poll say that the economy will be, quote, very, extremely important to their vote this fall. Back in 2020, that percentage was just 40%. In 2016, it was 46%. So this is much higher. The economy right now, at least, absolutely driving this election cycle. Two-thirds, 65%, that's a lot, calling it extremely important. And within those voters, those who say that the economy is extremely important to their vote, two-thirds of the overall electorate, Donald Trump has a lead head-to-head against Joe Biden on the economy, 62% to 30. Trump is up 32 points against Joe Biden on the economy among the vast majority of Americans who say that is an extremely important issue to them. Overall, 70% of poll respondents say that the economy in the U.S., economic conditions are poor. So that is just one piece of bad news after another for Joe Biden in this survey. And again, if this were just a complete outlier of a poll, maybe I wouldn't open with it. Now, frankly, I couldn't resist it. CNN polls just ruining CNN's weekend on White House Correspondents' Day weekend, no less. Oh, the humanity. But this poll is in line. Maybe it's a bigger lead for Trump, 6 points, 9 in the wider field. But as I said, you look at some of these other polls, Trump is ahead on average nationally and in most of the swing states. Now, I'll give you one word of warning, a disclaimer, and then another word of, if you're rooting for Trump, encouragement. These numbers are registered voters and in some cases U.S. adults. That is different than the people, the universe of people who will actually vote in November. And as I keep saying, Democrats clearly have an advantage right now among the people who are most likely to vote. If you are a locked-in, surefire, all-in voter, Biden leads. If you're a sometimes voter, occasional voter, Trump has a big lead with those people. They are just less reliable, by definition, in terms of turning out. And then Trump has, according to some polls, an even bigger lead among eligible non-registered voters. So there's a lot of work to do for the Republicans. And there was a story I saw recently about weak ground game metrics for the Trump campaign and the RNC. That is a flashing red light of warning for the Republicans. They've got 6 months to figure it out. to get the resources and the organization together to turn those people out and register those types of voters. Because it's not really a popularity contest or even a sentiment contest or necessarily a referendum on the incumbent. It is a competition of who can actually get their people to have their ballots in their hand and vote. That's the name of the game now. And Democrats have a significant lead on that factor. However, here's the positive note for the Trump campaign. Back to the CNN poll. They found that 17% of registered voters say that they are unfavorable in terms of their views on both Joe Biden and Donald Trump. So we call these the double disapprovers. I've talked about this many times before. We saw this in 2020. Almost one out of five voters don't like Trump and don't like Biden. They disapprove or have a negative opinion of both of them. That's a lot of voters. Among the double disapprovers, back in 2020, Joe Biden won them running away. They broke hard for Joe Biden. They're like, okay, I don't like either of these guys, but given the choices right now, I'm going with Joe. Big part of why Biden won in 2020, those double disapprovers going his way. In the new CNN poll, roughly the same number, 17%, say they are double disapprovers of both men, but this time it's different. Right now, within that group, Donald Trump leads by 12 points. That probably puts a shiver up the collective spine of the Democrat Party right now. This was not a poll they wanted to see yesterday. But it landed. It landed hard. And there's one more piece of it, component of it, that I want to explore as soon as we come back on the other side of this break. Just getting rolling on this Monday. It's the Guy Benson Show.
Same issues, but with a fresh perspective.
The Guy Benson Show.
Hey, folks, it's your man, Keyshawn Johnson, here to talk about Angie, formerly known as Angie's List, your go-to home services, marketplace for getting all your jobs done well. Now, you might be wondering, what exactly is Angie? Well, let me tell you, it's the nation's largest home services marketplace, connecting over 150 million homeowners with skilled professionals to tackle any project, big or small. As a homeowner myself, I always have things I want to work on for my house, whether it's general home renovations or fun projects like putting in a pool. With over 200,000 pros in their network, Angie makes it a breeze to research, compare, and hire pros, ensuring every job is done well. Whether you're fixing a leaky faucet or planning a full kitchen renovation, Angie's got your back. And get this, folks. Angie's pros aren't just any old contractors. They're your neighbors, often running small businesses right in your community. Plus, they've been rated and reviewed by others in your area. So you know you're getting quality service. So why stress over home projects when you can turn to Angie? From finding the best price to scheduling a pro at your convenience, Angie's got you covered every step of the way. So get started today at Angie.com. That's Angie.com or download the app today to get started on getting all your jobs done. That's Angie, your trusted ally in home services.
I'm Guy Benson. Thanks for tuning in. I'm talking about this absolute horror show of a CNN poll for Joe Biden with Donald Trump ahead outside the margin of error. There was one element of it that a lot of people are focusing on, although they're focusing on the wrong part of it because they're members of the media, of course. It's the Israel-Hamas war. Biden is so deep underwater on approval on this. 28% approve, 71% disapprove on how he's handling it. And among young people, it's 19% approve, 81% disapprove. So young people are really unhappy. So, of course, journalists are saying, see, look, unhappy young people, it's a big problem for Joe Biden. Subtext, he's not sucking up to the pro-Hamas crowd enough. Well, no, actually, among partisan Democrats, it's roughly split, 46% approve, 53% disapprove. But among Republicans and independents, he's getting crushed on this. Independent, sort of normie Americans, and Americans tend to side with Israel by large margins, by the way. Among independents, he is at 27% approve, 73% disapprove. That's independents. And it's not because independents, you know, hate Israel. or want a ceasefire or sympathize with Hamas, just the opposite. So he's pandering to the Hamas crowd and failing, and everyone else is standing by disgusted, including yours truly. More on that next.
Out of the gates and ready to go.
Hey, it's Hutton Withrow. Hot Mike is here on the Outkick Network. We've got your afternoon covered with the latest sports discussion, and it's available wherever you find your audio.
Daily analysis and news. He is hot. I am Mike. Actually, my name is Chad. His name is Jonathan. But you get the picture. We're going to bring it every single day. Whatever you want to call us, we'll respond to. We just want you to respond to what we're dishing out every day.
And while you're here, we hope you subscribe to the podcast, like, subscribe, and share.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
GuyBensonShow.com, our online home. Our podcast is free every day when the show is over. Thanks for listening. With us now is Eli Lake. He's a reporter at the Free Press and a contributing editor at Commentary, at Eli Lake on social. Eli, good to have you here.
Don't forget the podcast, Re-Education, coming back with the Free Press soon.
Fantastic. We love to see it. Or in this case,
always
love to hear it.
Always great to be here, by the way, Guy.
Of course.
I love your show.
Thank you. So I want to start with this, and it goes to a point you've been making on social media that I think is an important one, which is this notion that some journalists are actually really, I think, like seriously trying to pursue and trying to inculcate, which is, oh, there's just so many smears happening of these students on college campuses. They aren't these horrible people backing Hamas and saying these terrible things. Those are interlopers. Those are outside agitators, and these groups are being commingled and conflated on purpose to smear the students. Okay, let's explore that a little bit, because Students for, what is it, Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, they put out a social media post just over the weekend in which they had a few screenshots of the Houthis. So there's groups of Houthis. These are terrorists, Iran-backed terrorists, that had some posters made up in English, one of which says, "Dear American students, they can arrest you, but they can never break your spirit. Basically, we're with you." And then that's in English, and then they've got their other typical banners in the background, the Houthi slogan emblazoned on the banners, which read as follows, not in English: "Allahu Akbar, death to America, death to Israel, cursed be the Jews, victory to Islam." And the national organization of SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, tweeted out the photos of solidarity from an actual terrorist group, and they said, "Thank you, Yemen," with a heart emoji. This comes on the heels of Hamas endorsing the protests and Iran's supreme leader endorsing the protests. Of course, he murders protesters in his own country. You would think, at least from a PR perspective, if you hate Israel this much and you feel like it's useful to have journalists pretend like you're not pro-terrorism, you wouldn't advertise your endorsements from literal terrorists.
The Students for Justice in Palestine, you know, right after October 7th, you know, put out a tweet, and I forget exactly what it said, but it was around basically saying, you know, all praise the resistance. And the organization has been taking a lead role in what's really been a movement building up to these campus quad takeovers, or as the as my friend Leo Leibowitz calls it, the tentafada.
Yeah.
It gets to a serious issue, which is that the Western left fails to understand what I call the weak fascist problem, because they tend to only look at conflicts in terms of power dynamics. So that assumes that every time the weaker party is in the right, but it fails to account for the fact that there are sometimes conflicts where the weaker party, such as Hamas, is a fascist organization that has attacked a democratic country like Israel. And so it has really, I think, led not just the students. I mean, the students can be forgiven, I suppose. They're young. But the professoriate, some members of Congress, such as the squad, like Ilhan Omar, who said something absolutely disgusting over the weekend in an interview when she was visiting her daughter, who was, disciplined. This is it's a problem, basically, that sort of is like there's no way to account for the fact that just because you are the weaker party in a conflict does not mean you are in the right. Hamas started the war on October 7th. They violated a ceasefire. Their treatment of women, their treatment of gays and lesbians is absolutely atrocious. They exist outside of any notion of international law, let alone the rules of war. And so to find organizations in solidarity with it and then to sort of endure a kind of almost gaslighting campaign from the media to say, no, they just don't like all the suffering. And I'm sure there are many students, by the way, who are attracted to these protests and sit-ins and whatever, who really are just concerned because they see on TikTok and the news, you know, a lot of suffering caused by the war in Gaza. That's true. So I understand that. But the leaders of these protests, such as this Kimani Jones nonsense person, are absolutely atrocious. And you have to ask yourself, these people are being trained to be leaders of a liberal democracy? Are you out of your mind? This is somebody who you kind of proudly gave a rant about how we believe that all Zionists didn't have a right to live. That includes more than 90% of all Jewish people. Zionism just means that you believe that a Jewish state should exist.
Yeah, this was the kid at Columbia who said that we should all be grateful that he hasn't started murdering us yet.
Is anybody going to like critically look at the fact that there is video of this guy or they or whatever their pronouns are, where they're leading like automatons, like he's, you know, Jim Jones or something, like it looks like a cult where he is saying something and then the crowd says it after him. That just strikes me as a kind of example, an illustration of the illiberal elements now that have taken over the progressive movement. I've been on the show before. I hope the audience probably knows my views is that Israel has a right to defend itself and that a lot of the claims against Israel are hyperbole, exaggeration, in some cases outright falsehoods. But it's okay to just say, I think Israel might, I disagree with these tactics and it shouldn't do this and wouldn't it be better to have a ceasefire, et cetera. But the chants are from the rivers to the sea, Palestine will be free. That's a Hamas slogan. Globalize the Intifada. That is like a terrorism slogan. So when you use the, when you mimic the slogans of terrorist groups, when you will see the flags of terrorist groups in this organ, in some of these encampments, and you basically say that October 7th was justified resistance. Well, at what point do we have to sort of conclude, well, you're pro-terrorist.
Yes.
Right, by the way, to speak. I believe in free speech if you want to make your pro-terrorist views known. But you don't get to, outside observers who are looking at this should not, beat around the bush or pretend that that's not what's going on here.
Yeah, you also don't have a right to create, quote unquote, liberated zones on private or public property, and try to, in the process, like they're so proud of their activism, Eli, that they cover their faces, they sign petitions anonymously, and they try to throw journalists and cameras out of all of these encampments. This is a point that Noah Bloom has made.
Only the unfriendly ones, right. And then there's something else going on here, too, which is that we've all seen over the past, let's call it 7 or 10 years, college campuses have become hotbeds of speech regulations that are meant to protect the safety of various minorities. So when the only minority on campus that doesn't have the protection or gets to play under these new rules because they say, I'm feeling unsafe because you keep saying the only Jewish state should be destroyed, well, that's the only group that doesn't get to, kind of have a safety veto. Now, I happen to be against the safety vetoes. I think college campuses should be places of robust debate.
Yes.
But to claim that these students are representing free speech is to completely misunderstand what's been happening in recent years. What's actually happening here is that we've learned that there is an exception to, the rules against microaggressions. It's that if you're Jewish, you can be micro and in some cases macro-aggressed. And that
or
right
assaulted.
There, is that double standard is anti-Semitic, and that's really that's shame to the administrations in these places, less so for the students. But a student, I think Jewish students on campus today have every right to say, wait a second, I thought these were the rules. They're not the rules anymore when it comes to, you know, offending and making Jews feel unsafe. Get out of here. You know, I mean, I would like to I'd like the rules to be revamped, and I'm sure I'd imagine you do too, Guy, but the double standard is so grotesque. It's like, it's unbelievable.
No, it's like, you know, we don't say master bedroom and master bathroom anymore because that might make people think about slavery for some reason. That's the new thing. But you can chant for the Intifada, and that's perfectly fine. Totally protected free speech is what
Ronnie
is.
Jones. And listen, he's a kid, and I normally would not want to, you know, spend much time on college students because when I was a college student, I wrote and said, you know, some dumb things as well. But, you know, the school, he said these things. He live streamed it on his Instagram. He said, you know, I don't think Zionists should live. And, you know, if anybody comes at me, I will fight to kill. And, you know, Zionists are like Nazis and all of this crazy stuff in an actual Zoom meeting to talk about, you know, with administrators to talk about concerns over some of his social media posts. They did nothing.
No, it was a disciplinary meeting with Columbia administrators in which he said all of these things months ago, and only when it came to light publicly because he put it on his Instagram did they kick him off of campus. It's unclear if he's been suspended or expelled. But Columbia, I mean, we saw chanting the other night, again, going back to this lie from journalists, a number of journalists saying, oh, no, it's these smears against the students are so unfair. It's part of this right-wing hate machine and blah, blah, blah. They were chanting, students within the gates of Columbia, in Arabic, they were chanting about how they want to stomp on the head of Mahmoud Abbas, who's the Palestinian Authority leader, because he was insufficiently radical. So they're chanting violently about a Palestinian leader who isn't enough of a terrorist for their liking. And then they were chanting about ethnic cleansing against Jews in Israel. I mean, this is what they are saying on campus in Arabic. We have to understand what's going on here and see it for what it is. We've also seen enormous weakness at so many of these schools. I mean, at Harvard this weekend, they put up a Palestinian flag where the U.S. flag typically flies. At a very famous area of campus with a bunch of people chanting away. GW in D.C. asked the government to come in, the cops to come in and clear one of these illegal protests, and apparently the mayor's office and officials said, stand down, we're not going to allow that. It's bad optics to interfere with peaceful protests. And, of course, the protesters got the message, blew past the barricades, put the barricades onto a giant pile and started chanting late at night and into the night, globalized the Intifada, overrunning the few officers who were there. I mean, this type of so-called leadership from adults is emboldening these people, empowering these people, and there's now a showdown at Columbia right now because the school today gave these people, these students and others, a 2 p.m. deadline to get out or face all sorts of consequences. And as of right now, we're well past that deadline. We haven't seen anything except for faculty coming out to support the so-called protesters, and I mean, this is the gauntlet's been thrown, Eli, and now we'll see if Columbia is going to completely disgrace itself further or actually enforce some of these rules, which could get ugly.
Well, you know, I have a basic question here because I can understand why. I mean, I'm uncomfortable with the idea of the National Guard coming in or, like, you know, if you don't want to see police clashing with students, I mean, I kind of understand that. But why can't Columbia turn on the sprinklers? Is there somebody at the buildings and ground there who could just turn on the sprinklers? And then I think that'll probably drive a lot of these, you know, precious snowflakes away because, you know, who wants to get their tent filled with Aveeno products all wet? I mean, it's just absurd.
And well, the fact that it's come to this place.
Like, there's no porta potties for our, you know, illegal protests where we're preventing people from, like, using public spaces at the university is absurd.
No, it's ridiculous. And they've let it get away from them. And I think the biggest thing that has to happen beyond arrest or anything like that, you need to just start getting and identifying the ringleaders, the people who have behaved worst, and expelling them. And I think that will put the fear of God into quite a few of these people, and things will sort themselves out. But unless there are true consequences that the students believe will be real and lasting, you're going to get more of this. Quickly, Eli, before I let you go, I saw at USC, at one of these encampments, I believe it was USC, they did, and this is what we're seeing at a lot of them, they're saying, oh, no, we're not anti-Semitic. Anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. How dare you say that about us? Look, we have our very own Jews here, and they support us. Look, we're having a Seder. So they had a Seder, quote-unquote, over the weekend, a Seder dinner in the middle of the day, days late, and the Hebrew was all written backwards. And apparently no one there understood that any of these things might suggest that this is all a giant show. I just wonder what you make of that. The people pointing to are good Jews, which disproves the anti-Semitism supposed attack.
Well, I wrote a piece a few months ago for Commentary Magazine. I also did a podcast on this, on the history of what I call the Aza Jews, Jews who say, as a Jew, I am against the occupation and think that the genocide and blah, 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 blah. And there's a whole history, and it goes back, you could argue, to the Book of Maccabees, where there are Jews who side with the enemies of Jews. It's nothing particularly new. I focused on a figure named Johannes Pfefferkorn, who in the 16th century decided that, you know, he converted to Catholicism and helped lead an unsuccessful purge of all of Germany's Talmuds. So this is the kind of stuff that we're talking about. There is a kind of, there's a real ignoble history. It doesn't represent the vast majority of Jews in this country. Maybe it represents Jews on these campuses. I don't know, but it's not, that doesn't get you off the hook for basically supporting the elimination of the world's only Jewish state after it was horrifically attacked in an attempted genocidal act, although they didn't have the power to kind of conduct it. I just want to go back to one other thing, besides, because I think you're absolutely right.
30 seconds. 30 seconds,
yeah.
Eli.
You're absolutely right about the ringleaders guy. But there also has to be sort of an understanding just in our culture and our media in general. The Students for Justice for Palestine should be treated the same way that the Proud Boys or the Charlottesville organizers were treated. They are bigots. They are haters.
Yes.
They're anti-Semites. And once there's some of that social pressure, like, I don't want to be seen with you, then I think that we can maybe begin to turn this ship around. But until then, we're in a real pickle.
Yeah, SJP, all over the country, they are explicit terrorism glorifiers. Not in my words, in their words. I say believe them. You're absolutely right. Eli Lake, the Free Press, Commentary, the podcast, lots of ways to get his content. Eli, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Guy.
We'll be right back.
America is listening to The Guy Benson Show.
We continue on The Guy Benson Show. Eli Lake sort of rhetorically asked a question in the last segment. Do these basically virulently anti-Israel Jewish students, a small minority of Jews in the country, represent Jews on these campuses? And I can say with great confidence the answer is no. I've been hearing from Jewish students for months now, especially these last few days with these encampments, at a bunch of schools, particularly my own alma mater, Northwestern. Jewish students who are disgusted, heartsick, furious, frightened because of the actions of these mobs on their campuses. And they are particularly offended by the handful of Jewish students giving them cover to pretend that they're not anti-Semitic. At Northwestern, there was a giant sign with a Star of David crossed out with a red X. It's not subtle what they're doing. Most Americans, the vast majority of Americans, and especially Jews, want no part of this. End this madness. We'll be back.
A new generation of conservative talk. Right here, right now. Fair, fun, and backed by the trusted voices and reporting resources of Fox News. Fox News. You're listening to The Guy Benson Show. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It's a new hour here on The Guy Benson Show. We are live. We are in Charleston, South Carolina, and we are very grateful that you're listening. GuyBensonShow.com is our website. The podcast is free and on demand
every day when the show is over. Fox News alert as we enter this middle hour. The Dow up today, 146 points in the green at the close, finishing up at 38,386. That market update, sponsored by Americans for Prosperity, whose mission is based on timeless principles, expanding freedom and opportunity for all Americans. You can join the largest grassroots group in America today at AmericansForProsperity.org/guy, and you can find and join an AFP chapter near you. Joining us now is U.S. Senator Steve Daines, Republican of Montana. He is the chairman of the NRSC this cycle. And, Senator, good to have you back on the show.
Hey, glad to join you, Guy.
Before we get into these races and the map for Senate Republicans this year, I just want to quickly get your reaction to the explosion of anti-Semitism, chaos, lawlessness across so many campuses on our country, in our country right now. We were talking a bit about it in the last hour. New developments seemingly by the minute. I know you've been very concerned about this.
Look, Guy, it's shocking to see what's happening across these campuses. This is rooted in anti-Semitism and it's hate. This has no place in America. You know, everybody has a right to free speech, but the First Amendment does not protect the right to threaten, to intimidate Jewish students, to disrupt classes. You know, you look at the emphasis on these universities. They will talk all day, these elites, about embracing diversity and inclusion as long as Jewish students and Jewish professors are excluded. So this is just the hypocrisy that's going on, and frankly, this dangerous ideology that we're seeing across campuses in our country. You know, Guy, we did a little research on the amount of money, federal money, going to some of these universities. Columbia, last fiscal year, received $1.2 billion from the federal government. Yale, $776 million. Harvard, $676 million. UT Austin, which is, you know, we're watching this before our very eyes today, received about $646 million. And that's why one of the actions we're taking is I've joined several of my Republican colleagues. By the way, zero Democrats, only Republicans, are calling for the defunding of the universities that are promoting anti-Semitism. One last point, too. When you hear this chant, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. This is a slogan that we're hearing across the country with these anti-Semitic protests. That phrase calls for the destruction of the state of Israel, for the removal of the Jewish people. This is very, very dangerous. Can you imagine for a moment if there was a center-right or conservative group with this kind of action that was promoting, you know, the removal of any ethnic group on campus? They would be immediately condemned and arrested. And so this is why we must stand firm at this, I think, dangerous moment in our history as a nation to full-throat to condemn what's going on and make sure we have moral clarity at this moment when, frankly, there's a lot of hate and evil brewing on campuses across our country.
You know, a number of weeks ago, there was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal talking about Dearborn, Michigan, as the capital of jihad in the United States. And you had a bunch of Democrats just jumping out of their skins to condemn the Wall Street Journal and the author of that piece. And we didn't see quite as much condemnation from those people when just weeks later you watched and listened to Death to America chants in the streets of Dearborn, Michigan. And part of the reason why those condemnations weren't forthcoming is because it's not a secret. The Democrats have decided that the pro-Hamas hate rallies and these mobs represent at least some significant portion of their base upon whom they're going to rely to win elections in November. And in the state of Michigan, there's a Senate race where the Democrats are putting someone forward who has been absolutely silent, is my understanding, about some of these hate rallies, even on her own alma mater's campus. A real profile in courage, it would seem, in that state.
You know, Guy, this is a moment as leaders in our country when we need to be outspoken and to have moral clarity on this very important issue. This is the problem the Biden administration has. is that first of all, there's no moral basis to the beliefs right now at the White House. They don't know what to do. That's why you've got Blinken over in the Middle East on one hand trying to promote a deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which would be a very good thing, but at the same time telling the Israelis what they can and can't do as it relates to securing their nation, protecting themselves from the terrorists, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, and Iran. So they're just spinning out of control in the White House. I just can envision what's going to happen in August when the Democrats have their national convention in Chicago. This is going to be a mess, as you're going to see so many of these anti-Semitics there protesting, anti-Israel, the hate for Jews, for Israel will be on full display. The Democrats know this is a huge political problem for them, never mind the moral problem. They know this is a political problem, and that's why in Michigan, you've got a guy like Mike Rogers, the Republican, running for that open seat. And open seats are always easier seats usually to win than having an incumbent in place. Senator Stabenow retired, so Michigan's an open seat. But the Democrats have a problem in their so-called blue wall, which is Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. They know these are very important battleground states for the presidency, but all three are very important battleground states for the U.S. Senate. And so when you have Michigan, that race is tied with Mike Rogers at the moment. He was former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, just a wonderful leader. He has moral clarity on Israel. He has moral clarity on condemning anti-Semitism full-throated without stuttering, unlike his opponent. And so when you've got Dearborn, Michigan, they're chanting death to America. When you're seeing the protests erupting around the nation, Mike Rogers has clarity. His opponent doesn't know what to do. They're running for cover because they know they've got a huge political problem on both sides.
Yeah, exactly. So there's sort of like Alyssa Slotkin is her name, who tries to present herself as a kind of more moderate Democrat. But when the chips are down, she votes with her party, you know, nearly 100% of the time. And with so much at stake, just good and evil when it comes to Israel and Hamas, she'll put out occasional statements, but not in ways that would cause any potential political pain or risk to herself. When leadership is required, she is not showing it. So that's Michigan, roughly tied based on some of the polls that I've seen. You just referenced that. Wisconsin, that place is always tied, right? The election for the presidency is almost exactly, you know, Trump's up, I think, 1 point on average. It seems like a tougher road there because it's an incumbent running for the Democrats, but not an impossible one at all. For Eric Hovde, who we've had on this program, the Republican, a businessman running there. We also have enjoyed having a Dave McCormick here on the show. He's up against this scion of privilege and political power, Bob Casey, famous last name in Pennsylvania. Polls showing Casey still ahead right now. How are you approaching those races in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania? How winnable are those?
Yeah, well, you said it exactly right. These states are both on the razor edge for the presidency, particularly Wisconsin. Pennsylvania will be as well. This is going to be a plus or minus one or two state, perhaps, by the time it gets to November at the presidential level. Trump right now is leading in Pennsylvania. Wisconsin's tied. Michigan is leading. But here's what's different for Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania and Eric Hovde in Wisconsin is they both cleared the primary. There's no primary in Pennsylvania for Dave McCormick. That really hurt our efforts back in 22. Dave McCormick has a clear shot, has no primary opponent, so he can stay on the attack and clarifying the difference between himself and Bob Casey. And as you know, Guy, every single Democrat is trying to sound as Republican as they can in some of these states. But the reality is they're voting with Joe Biden 95 to 98% of the time. I mean, who wants to be attached to Joe Biden? This will be the dilemma. It'll be fun to watch, Guy. When Joe Biden's campaigning in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in Wisconsin, I just wonder if those Democrat Senate candidates want to be on the same stage. You know, he has the worst numbers in 70 years. He makes Jimmy Carter look Reagan-esque right now. Biden's numbers are so bad.
So you might see if Biden or Harris show up in a state, you might see some scheduling conflicts, perhaps?
Well, you might. I can just imagine they'll have some kind of cutout of Ronald Reagan on the stage or something here at a separate rally where they're far away from Joe Biden. But that's because, you know, the nation, they've got Joe Biden figured out. I mean, truly, guy. His numbers could hardly get any worse. They probably will between now and Election Day, because it looks like every macro factor is only getting worse for President Biden, not getting better. And so it's not going to be a pretty night in November if you are Joe Biden and anybody attached to him and his agenda. The voters, these independent voters, are running away from Joe Biden. And this is the crazy part about this election, is how unpopular Joe Biden is. And that's why great candidates like Dave McCormick, like Mike Rogers, like Eric Hovde, these are all stand-up men. And we've got great women as well in some of races like New Mexico with Nella Domenici. But I tell you, these are all ready to lead senators from day one. They're not going to need any training wheels once they get elected and start serving in January 25.
So we'll see what happens in the upper Midwest, in the Rust Belt. Looking a few other places, you've got almost a slam dunk. You don't want to jinx anything, but West Virginia looks like that is going to be a flip. Joe Manchin is out. It's an open seat. That state is super red. Donald Trump will be on the ticket. So, I mean, Democrats, I don't think, are going to really even try to contest that in a serious way. Then you've got some potentially low-hanging fruit for Republicans to go out and pick up additional seats they need to net two to guarantee a Senate majority. And I know you think that they can do a lot better than just two seat gains. But you look at Ohio, you look at your state, Montana. Let's talk about those two states. You know, Ohio is a Trump plus eight or nine state. But Sherrod Brown has been a tough nut to crack. He's got a machine in that state. Do things change for him this cycle? And then the same question about John Tester. I don't want to make it too awkward, because you serve with him together in the Senate. I've always called him Chuck Schumer with a flat top haircut. I mean, he looks the part of a moderate, and he votes Chuck Schumer's way all the time. He's gotten a little lucky in terms of what cycles he's been up in his opponents. Seems to have a really good opponent this time. How do you handicap those two races?
Yeah, well, just before we talk specifically about Montana and Ohio, I think it's important when you step back and look at the map in 24, that we have three red states that have Democrats defending their reelection for the Senate. And that's what you mentioned, West Virginia, Montana, Ohio. But these states are very red. I mean, every single statewide official in West Virginia, in Montana, in Ohio is a Republican. And Trump will win West Virginia by 35 to 40 points, will win Montana by 15 to 20 points, and Ohio by 6 to 10 points. And so they've got incredible headwind for those three states. And you're exactly right. Sherrod Brown and John Tester have had the benefit of running the last two times. You go back to 2012, that was a pretty popular Obama presidential election year. 18 was a midterm. This is now the first time they will be on the ballot when President Trump is also on the ballot. Those are Trumpy states. You know, Montana and Ohio have clearly become more conservative, more red, since the last time John Tester was on the ballot, as well as Sherrod Brown. And by the way, on West Virginia, you're right, that race is over. I'm a conservative forecaster, but the Democrats have given up West Virginia. And that was not by accident. We recruited a very strong candidate in Governor Jim Justice. We had President Trump endorse him, and that then sent Joe Manchin to the exits, and he retired. So we picked up that seat without having to spend virtually any money. Had Joe Manchin run, that would have been a $50 to $100 million Senate race at least. Now you go to Montana. Tim Sheehy, latest polls, one public poll, and our internals have him up a couple points, which I'm surprised he's even up at this point. It's hard when you're just starting out. Your right. Name ID lacks a guy who's served, you know, for 18 years in the U.S. Senate. But he's actually right now, they're neck and neck in this race. That's a great position for Tim Sheehy to be in between now and the election. I've watched Montana closely for a long time. When I ran for my reelect in 20, guy, you know, the Democrat thought they had this race. In fact, Charlie Cook had this as a lean Democrat state all the way to Election Day. We ended up winning by 10 points, 55-45. The reality is, in Montana, we're seeing center-right voters fleeing California, Oregon, Washington. We call these folks refugees coming to Montana, not missionaries. They're coming to join us, not to change us. And consequently, the state has gotten redder since the last time John Tester ran. By the way, he only won by 18,000 votes in 2018. Just quantifiably, we have had more center-right voters register in Montana than his winning margin back in
18. Yeah, so I mean, those headwinds – sorry to jump in, Senator, because we're up on a hard break. Those headwinds are going to be tough, but – you know, he's going to have a ton of money and party support behind him. Same with Sherrod Brown in Ohio. There's other states we didn't even get to, plus some of the red states and Republican seats that the Democrats are going to spend a boatload in Texas and maybe Florida. So there's more to this picture. Hopefully we can have this conversation again in a couple weeks and get an update based on what you're seeing on the ground, what your internal polls are showing as well. Hopefully you're open to that because we would love to have you back.
I will, Guy, our biggest issue is resources right now. Truly, we're being outspent, outraged 3-1. That's where we need help. Thanks,
Guy. And where can people help?
Boy, I'll tell you, you can go to Senate24.com. We've got a website there that we can direct dollars directly to candidates. So that's the first place to go. And the $25, $30 donations make a big, big difference right now. That's how the Democrats are beating us. They've got millions coming in through small donations. We've got to answer what they're doing at the moment.
NRSC chairman in the 2024 cycle and U.S. Senator from Montana, Steve Daines, our guest on the Guy Benson Show. Senator, talk soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Guy. You bet. Bye-bye.
We will step aside and come right back after this short break.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
I'm Guy Benson. So I just saw a video. This is from UCLA, which is a public university, right? Not even a private school getting all that public money, as we were just talking to Senator Daines about, but a public university in Southern California, obviously, Los Angeles. And the video depicts a Jewish student trying to get to class. The entrance to the building is right over there. He's pointing at it. And there's some barricades up. There's some campus security guards. And then there's a little pack of like seven masked Hamas supporters with their Palestinian headscarves blocking him from walking through this part of his own campus at a public university to get to class because this is the territory that they say they control, like a gang of thugs. We control this territory. You can't come. So they are physically blocking with their bodies this Jewish student's ability to walk to class on his own campus. And at one point, he puts his hands in the air and sort of turns his back and tries to walk through anyway to get to class. And they bring in this giant thug to help block him. This is a public school getting public dollars at which Jews are not being able to walk to class. Their access is being blocked by a mob while security just stands there and does nothing. I'm afraid the only solution like this, in this situation, expensive lawsuits.
In the swamp, not of the swamp. Guy Benson.
Just past the halfway point here on the Guy Benson Show on this Monday edition from Charleston, South Carolina. Delighted to have you here. Thanks for tuning in. If you miss any of the program, we've got a podcast for that. It is free. It is on demand. It is every day. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. With us now from our D.C. studios is Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, retired, a Fox News contributor. He was the chief of staff of the National Security Council during the Trump administration, author of the book War by Other Means. General, always good to have you on the show.
Hey, Guy, good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So I want to start with this possibility of a ceasefire. I know there's been some rumblings of it involving Israel's war in Gaza. Hamas has been rejecting every proposal, basically, for a ceasefire, making totally insane demands. But this one might be in the offing. There's some positive chirping from the U.S. administration. I guess the question is, from a diplomatic standpoint, it's one thing. From a military standpoint, it seems like the objective of the United States is to prevent Israel from finishing the job in Rafah, which is the final stronghold of Hamas. And the argument would be from the administration, well, we want to avoid some sort of, you know, humanitarian disaster because it's a densely populated city and a lot of people have gone there because the rest of the area has been wrecked. I'm sympathetic to that point, but the Israelis have said over and over again, we are absolutely going into Rafah and we are going to finish off Hamas. I'm just trying to figure out, is there some sort of universe in which both of these things are possible, where the hostages maybe get released, there's something of a ceasefire, and then either sooner or later, Israel can follow through on what they have promised, not just to the world, but to their own people when it comes to this terrorist organization that committed the atrocities of October 7th just a few months ago.
Yeah, Guy, I think really they're going to, the Israelis are going to have to go into Rafah, because that's going to be truly the end of the beginning, and then they're going to have to figure out what's going to happen diplomatically, economically, and militarily going forward. But they've got to do it. And this thing with the ceasefire, I think it's just foolish for anybody to consider that. Even now with the Israelis, we're into the seventh month. Look, Hamas didn't even know where all the hostages are. They can't even report them out. There's no proof of life for a lot of them. They have not let the International Red Cross come in and talk to them. And I think what all the Israelis are letting Hamas do is actually build up their forces in Rafah and build up defenses in depth, as we would call it in the military. So when the Israelis come in, and they're going to have to go in, it's just a lot harder fight. You're going to see more collateral damage, read civilians and buildings and infrastructure.
Yeah, so
I think now it's a pipe dream. I wouldn't buy into it at all.
Okay. I mean, and we'll see, and maybe it would be a temporary one. But what you just said at the end of that answer there is what concerns me. Because every time you give Hamas more leash, right, when you afford them more time, they use and exploit that time for their horrible, evil, dastardly, manipulative purposes. And their best chance of survival, to the extent that, I mean, a lot of them are dead, but to the extent that they can survive, it relies on the world community pressuring Israel not really to finish the job, and for them to make it as difficult for the Israelis as possible to have success in this one last offensive, in this one last sort of foothold in Rafah. So if you give them more time to embed themselves further with, you know, civilians and go into schools and hospitals like they do all over the place, you're kind of, if you're the Israelis, you're kind of making your job even more difficult. I think the Israelis, of course, understand that. They're not stupid. They understand what the stakes are. If, in fact, this does happen, and Netanyahu has said, defense minister has said, trust us, it's happening, what will be the biggest challenge in your mind, militarily, for Israel to be successful? Because you want to go into Rafah not just to keep your own promise, you want to achieve the objective, which isn't easy, but they believe it's attainable. What does success look like in Rafah, and how do they get there?
Yeah, when you look at it, for people who have not had a military background, look, time is not on your side if you're on the offense, and it is on your side if you're on the defense. And that's what the Hamas is. They're on the defense. When you look at a place like Rafah, it allows them to build up forces, allows them to build up infrastructure, allows them to build up fortifications. So the advantage always goes to the defender on a city fight, which you see. And what the Israelis are going to have to do, they're basically going to go with what we used to call a cordon and search. Think of a giant checkerboard. And they're going to have to actually use a checkerboard-like overlay on the city of Rafah and then go after it. And what does an end state look like? It means defeating the military forces of Hamas. They're not going to get every single terrorist. That's just not going to happen. It never does. But they've got to destroy their military capability. That's number one. And the second thing they must do is they must reduce, eliminate, eradicate the leadership of Hamas at all levels. I don't care where they're at or where they're found. And that's the two things they're going to have to do. And then that's the reason I made the comment earlier, Guy, that this is really the beginning of the end of the beginning, because this phase, once it's done, then you've got to figure out, okay, what are the next steps on going back and restructuring, you know, reconsolidating, redevelopment of Gaza and actually the West Bank as well. So this is the problem they run into. And it's a tough military operation, because you know for a fact, and you made a comment, that Nakba fighters, the Hamas fighters, are going to integrate themselves with civilians, and you're going to have civilian casualties. That's the reason I say to everybody, look, you have to have a strong heart on this, and you have to understand there's going to be collateral damage. There is in every single war. But the Israelis didn't start this fight. Hamas started this fight. You must let them continue this operation until it's complete. I mean, the Israelis. And I think they're going to do it. I think they met with their commanders this weekend, and I think they're getting ready to go in, and I think they'll do it as precisely as they can. But nothing is very precise in war when it's built up areas. It's going to be tough fighting. It's door-to-door. It's floor-to-floor. You use precision weapons as best you can, but there's a lot of people who are going to get hurt that are not necessarily fighters.
Well, and that's by design from Hamas. This is such an important point, because people accuse Israel of genocide, which is just a completely insane lie. That's nowhere near the definition of genocide, what they're doing. It's just the opposite. It's just night and day. They invert everything. Israel is trying to avoid civilian casualties. Hamas is trying to increase civilian casualties because they feel like that's their ticket to survival. If there's enough pain inflicted upon innocent people by their own tactics, Hamas's own tactics, forcing the Israelis' hand this way, they are putting their people, as they always have, in as much harm's way as possible for their own terroristic, selfish goals. That's what Israel is up against. That's really tough. That's tough sledding, especially when you've got your allies in the world, principally us, where the leadership is wobbly at best and trying to convince you not to finish the job. That's what makes me so angry about this. One other question about leadership before we move on to a different topic here, General. We know for a fact that some of these leaders have been harbored in Qatar, some of them living in extreme luxury, five-star hotels. A lot of them have become millionaires while their people have suffered. They don't care about that. They care about killing Israelis, destroying Israel, killing Jews, and making a lot of money for themselves. That they've demonstrated this for a long time. If Israel is able to, let's say, effectively destroy the military capacity of Hamas in this war, but some of the top commanders, top leadership, still out there somewhere in the world, either in Gaza or elsewhere, do you anticipate that the Israelis will then pursue something like Operation Wrath of God 2.0, like after the Munich Olympics in Black September, where they then had a long memory and over time went all around the world, Europe, elsewhere, taking these people out one by one? Are we going to see that again in the months or years to come?
Yes, I do. And I think when you look at it, they have to do that. It's sort of like, you were right. You brought up what happened after the Munich Olympics massacre. They're going to have to do the same thing with Hamas. You know, this is one of the things that kind of bothers me, is where I'm surprised that the president hasn't picked up the phone and called Sheikh Al-Tamim, you know, who runs Qatar, and says, get those guys out of there, you know, because you are actually harboring terrorists there, and the leaders of Hamas actually live in luxury there. But I would say I'm pretty sure, I put a lot of money on it, the Israelis are going to go, and they're going to eradicate that leadership. And they need to, and they should. It sends a clear message to everybody that you're not going to be hidden behind sanctuaries. Just go after it. So I tell everybody, just you kind of accept that. That's kind of the way it is. Oh, by the way, we've done that before. When you look at what we did with Soleimani, you look at people like that are leaders of terrorism, and you just have to reduce or eradicate them. Bin Laden's another one. Al-Baghdadi was another one. Mm-hmm. And it just happens. And I think that's necessary. And I do believe they will do it.
There's a report I saw earlier from NBC News that the Israelis now fear that the International Criminal Court, this is the ICC connected to the UN, they might issue arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and other top Israeli officials, and they'll also say for some Hamas leaders as well, arrest warrants for both sides, which is exactly the kind of both sidesism that we saw actually from President Biden recently, which I think is just disgraceful. There is no equality or parity between these two sides. You have a genocidal terrorist organization that deliberately targets civilians and then embeds themselves within civilians, and then you have an elected leadership of a democracy trying to prosecute to the best of their ability a defensive war after an atrocity within their own borders. I just wonder, I don't really give the ICC any credibility or authority in my mind. I don't think that they're a legitimate organization. In terms of public opinion around the world, maybe some people think this is more important. But I just wonder, in your mind, as someone who has served at a very high level in a presidential administration, and if Trump wins again, perhaps you'll be back there, what would it mean to the United States, especially under different leadership, if the ICC decides that they're going to be letting, you know, subpoenas or warrants fly against the elected leadership of Israel?
You know, this is one of those, I'm just shocked that this administration hasn't used the bully pulpit, and especially President Biden, and said, very simply, say to the world court, say, this is absurd. You know, when you look at it, you know, Netanyahu is democratically elected in his nation. It's a democratic country. And you go, where are you coming from? And you can't do this moderation, this equivalence, which they're trying to do. It's just wrong. And
they got
this
attacked.
Is one of those, they have to set this
they got attacked.
To do it. Yep.
But this goes to the whole genocide slander, where a lot of people rooting for Hamas or sympathizing with Hamas, or just people who hate Israel, hate the Jews, it's a whole motley crew of them, they were celebrating what happened on October 7th openly, and then on a dime, when Israel finally began the process of fighting back, then they just turned en masse to new talking points, which was, this is a genocide. And they've used that to justify virtually anything that they're willing to say or do against the Israelis. Again, going back to your experience militarily, General, just for the benefit of this audience, when you hear the term genocide, what does that actually mean in real life? And how does that definition apply to what we've seen from the Israelis over the last 6-7 months?
Yeah, you know, what you've seen happening, you, when you say genocide, go back to World War II, you go to places like Rwanda, which happened in Africa, when that actually happened there. And that's just the elimination of a race, and that's what you're seeing. That's what Hamas wants. You know, Hamas wants genocide. The Israelis don't. The Israelis have been trying to bring them along for a long time and at least, you know, stay away from them or bring them back together. It's what we try to do with the Abraham Accords. But, I mean, this is one of those, there's no equivalence. And anybody who thinks there's an equivalence, I think, really needs to read history and needs to think their way through it. And that includes college administrators, college students, I don't care who it is. But to accuse or even equate the Israeli government with genocide or a leader of the Israeli government with genocide is beyond the pale. It's absolutely, you know, foolish is too kind of a word to use, Guy, but it kind of is foolish.
Yeah, I think for some people it's useful idiocy. For other people it's evil. Yeah. Right. Some people don't know better, which is on them. Some people do know better, which I think is worse. Let's talk about Ukraine and Russia. This foreign aid did go through at long last. Congress passed it, big bipartisan vote. Biden signed it. In the immediate term, what does that mean for the Ukrainian military? How quickly can we get them equipment? What do they need? And what are the next steps for them? I know I threw a lot at you there, but... Yeah. This is a new phase of the war, again, a defensive war in this case by Ukraine against Russia's aggression. They're going to have more money, more equipment. What does that look like? What are the priorities?
Yeah, look, right now the Ukrainians are on their back foot. They're on the defense right now. The Russians are on the advance. Not major advance, but enough. And that's because the Ukrainians came out of the summer offensive that they tried to have did not work well. What the Russians are doing when they were going back to the way the Russians fight with mass, a lot of people, a lot of artillery. You know, they're looking at 5, 6, 7 to 1 on soldier level. You're taking 1 to 10 on artillery level. They've got close air support. So you're looking at the equipment coming in, and the artillery is going to be the big thing. But the biggest thing that you're looking at, what they actually need, is something they need to do themselves. They need to man up. What I mean by man up, they need to basically mobilize them more than they have because they're being beaten by sheer massive numbers of people. That's one of the reasons why Zelensky, the former general that left and is now the ambassador of Ukraine, to the United Kingdom, talked about mobilizing 200,000 to 300,000. They're going to have to do that, whether they like it or not. I know it'll affect their economy a bit, but they're going to have to match up to the Russians. And once they match up with the Russians, then we get the artillery support and they get close air support. But we didn't provide that early enough when we should have. And I'm talking a year ago when Ukraine had the Russians on their back foot. Now they're not. The Russians are on the move.
Can they turn the tide?
Not major, but it's bad. I'm sorry?
Do you think they can turn the tide?
The Ukrainians, I think they're going to have to go to almost a stalemate. I don't think they can regain that land, not unless they fully mobilize. It take a while to do it. It's so hard to go back on the offensive. They're not trained to do that. I mean, we actually trained them a lot differently than we probably should have. And the Russians have learned their lessons. They learned the lessons the hard way after 2.5 years of fighting. They're now fighting the way that the Russians have always fought from World War II on, which is a lot of mass, a lot of artillery, a lot of close air support. And I think the best you can look at right now in Ukraine is a stalemate. I think the chance of them evicting the Russian forces right now from the land that they've taken will be almost too hard to do. It's a hard thing to say. It's a harsh thing to say. I know that, but it's just sheer numbers, and it's just too hard to do.
Pretty bleak assessment. We'll see how it pans out in the coming months. We will revisit the question with Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, retired, now a Fox News contributor, former chief of staff at the National Security Council and the Trump administration. General, as always, thank you for your time and insights.
Thanks, Guy. Thanks for having me.
And since we brought up the definition of genocide, I want to play a soundbite that you need to hear from a politician you know right after this.
Miss a minute, miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
We continue here on The Guy Benson Show. We were just talking about genocide and the real definition versus the fake definition with General Kellogg. Well, at Columbia, we saw a few days ago AOC showed up all smiles and solidarity. This was after it was revealed that one of those leaders had called for the deaths of all Zionists. She was there, big fan apparently. Ilhan Omar, also of the squad, whose daughter's been involved there, she has also made her presence known at Columbia. And while she was there, she was asked a question by a reporter. Here's that exchange, cut 16 from a few days ago.
do you think this will translate to the Jewish students who are facing anti-Semitism here on campus?
So I actually met a lot of Jewish students that are in the encampment. And I think it is really unfortunate that people don't care about the fact that all Jewish kids should be kept safe and that we should not have to tolerate anti-Semitism or bigotry for all Jewish students, whether they are pro-genocide or anti-genocide.
It's amazing. This woman is an anti-Semite. It's been established over and over again with the things that she has said and done. She's been warned. She's been offered explanations why certain things are offensive. She does them anyway. Jews hypnotizing the world, all about the Benjamins. You can go down the list, the hit list. This is an anti-Semite pretending that she's against anti-Semitism, and then in the next breath says that pro-Israel Zionist Jews, the vast majority of Jews in this country, are, quote, pro-genocide. What an absolute cretin. It's a member of Congress from Minnesota. I'm the squad. Final hour of the Guy Benson Show is coming up next. Joe Concha is here with his review of the Howard Stern interview with the president, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and more straight ahead.
Raise your glass to the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. Brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage is taking America by storm. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's Guy Benson.
It is the happy hour here on the Guy Benson Show on this Monday evening. Thank you so much for tuning in. I am Guy Benson. GuyBensonShow.com is our website, our online home. Podcast is always free and always on demand right there or at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. This hour is sponsored by our good friends at the Finnish Long Drink. We are fans, especially as the weather gets warmer. Cold, refreshing long drink is just fantastic. If you're 21 plus only, of course, please always drink responsibly. TheLongDrink.com is their website. TheLongDrink.com. You can find out where they're sold near you. You can order online. Different options. So over the weekend, I was in Oregon for an event. And then yesterday, I flew here to Charleston, South Carolina. That is where we are doing the program today and tomorrow. Very pleased to be here in Charleston. Joining us now, Joe Concha, Fox News contributor, author of the book, Come On, Man. And Joe, it's great to have you back.
Happy Monday, Guy. How was your weekend?
All right. It was fine. It was a little busy, traveling a lot, but glad to have you here. I did miss, because I was out of D.C., the White House Correspondents' Dinner and all the accompanying parties and glitzy events and all of that. Fine by me. The event itself was kind of as expected. I saw one headline that Colin Jost, who is the presiding comedian on Saturday night, was able to win over a very tough crowd by calling Joe Biden a decent man. Here's, in fact, the soundbite of this hilarious joke, I guess. This is cut 36.
He voted for you, and the reason that he voted for you is because you're a decent man. My grandpa voted for decency, and decency is why we're all here tonight. Decency is how we're able to be here tonight.
Joe, he's addressing the president there about how his grandpa voted for him as a decent man, and the room applauds. However, did he win over that room? What a mystery.
Sorry, I'm just threw up my mouth a little bit, so it was hard to talk for a moment. I went there a couple of years ago. You may have been there the same year. And it's the same kind of comedian every year. It's either Comedy Central or, in this case, it's Saturday Night Live. We knew exactly how it was going to go. He'll take some light barbs, probably pre-approved jokes by the White House about Biden's age, and then otherwise save the haymakers for Donald Trump and for Fox News. I did enjoy how he's talking about decency because, you know, nothing says decency, Guy, quite like pretending your own granddaughter doesn't exist until you're forced to acknowledge her, a four-year-old, mind you, when Maureen Dowd writes a mean column about it. So, yeah, the decency card, I don't think you could play at this point with Joe Biden, given everything we know about him now.
He also, when he gave his remarks, because President Trump did not attend these dinners. Biden is back to attending them. In fact, I saw that the Biden campaign or the White House, or some Biden entity, was saying if Trump wins again, there might never be another White House correspondence dinner, which is just like, I think, over-the-top hyperbole and also something that does not bother a single person in the country. Even if Trump somehow was able to end the tradition, I think you would have a handful of journalists mad about it and not a single other soul ticked off, because it's this sort of celebrified, self-congratulatory event, much like Oscar season or award season in Hollywood, but for journalists who people dislike even more than the Hollywood set based on public opinion polling. One of the concerns that you've raised, Joe, on this show a number of times is the extent to which this president avoids questions, particularly tough questions, because he took some questions the other day in a radio interview. We'll talk about that in a sec. But Biden, in front of the press, poked fun at this in his remarks on Saturday night, Cut 33.
To all my friends in the press and Fox News, some of you complain that I don't take enough of your questions. No comment. Of course, the New York Times issued a statement blasting me for, quote, active and effectively avoiding independent journalists. Hey, if that's what it takes to get the New York Times to say I'm active and effective, I'm for it.
Big laugh there from the crowd. Not really a very funny joke at all. And he's making fun of his lack of access and his lack of accountability when it comes to questions. This is generally the type of thing that the White House press corps actually is upset about, and I guess he's just kind of winking at them, and they're fine with it.
Good. If they're so upset about it, Guy, they should boycott the next press briefing and say why. Right? Because you know they would be doing this if this was another president named Trump. The media right now is as popular as, you know, gas station sushi, right? So to your point, for them to be congratulating themselves on a job well done when more and more people, you use the right words, not just distrust, but dislike, because they're so pious and elitist and condescending. I'm not saying all of them are, and there are some good journalists out there, but I'm talking about a good chunk, a good majority. I mean, this whole thing, well, the White House correspondence dinner may not go on if Trump is elected. Well, it went on when he was in office. So what do you think is going to happen when he goes back in? All these predictions about what Trump is going to do when he gets in office, we already have a preview of what he's going to do. He won't go to the correspondence dinner because why would he subject himself to that? And instead, they will go on and they'll use it as painting themselves as martyrs, carrying the torch while the president decides not to go. Joe Scarborough even said on his morning show not too long ago that Donald Trump will execute journalists if reelected. I mean, it's so ridiculous to the point where it's not having any impact because it's that ridiculous, Guy.
Yep. Now, he won't sit down, the president, with really any serious journalists. He does it once in a blue moon. Our colleague Brett Baier has been after him every single week for his whole presidency, and it's just been stonewalling. No, no, no. And in fairness to Brett, it's not just him. It's almost everyone all of the time, but an exception was made on Friday. I was leaving Midtown Manhattan. I'd been in New York for some TV stuff, and I was trying to get out of my hotel and get to the airport, and multiple blocks of Midtown right near Times Square were closed down, right near Fox, and that's because the president had actually deigned to show up for a lengthy one-on-one interview with Howard Stern on Sirius XM Radio. Howard Stern, sort of course, a very well-known name, but this was not going to be a hostile interview or even an adversarial interview in any way. Howard Stern is a lefty. He's also like one of these totally obsessive COVID people who, I think is still probably in a basement in a mask by himself. That's Howard Stern's approach to that issue. And so let's just talk, for example, about Cut 26. This was sort of the preamble of Stern welcoming the president to his show to give you a sense of the nature of the exchange that was going to follow. Let's listen.
You know, the reason I'm so excited to talk to you was because I wanted to understand the tragedy in your life and how you dealt with it. And you're the kind of leader I love, because we're lucky to have you in the Oval Office and serving as the father of the country. Because if you're a good father to your family, which you are, I know you'd be a good father to the country. And I want to thank you for providing a calming influence, an organized administration post-COVID, getting that vaccine out. I remember what the world was like at that point, getting NATO, getting us to feel comfortable, standing up to Putin, the incredible large growth in the jobs, unemployment rate down. I'll give you your greatest hits. The lowest uninsured rate in history. 4 out of 5 Americans are covered for less than $10 a month. Knocking off a few ISIS leaders, cutting the emissions in half. I mean, you've always been an environmentalist.
Joe Concha, that is, I mean, you can actually pick apart a few of the claims there, but we don't have time for that. That's not the point. Yeah. This, unsurprisingly, is the interview that President Biden and his team felt comfortable with. My goodness.
And you realize, Guy, that all those talking points that Howard just listed, he doesn't know that off the top of his head. The White House provided that.
No, he was reading them. He was reading from a list.
Exactly. Cut emissions in half? When exactly did that happen?
That's not a thing.
Right. And that's the thing. Joe Biden has done now 2 interviews with Jason Bateman. We know him from Ozark, other places. Fine, he has a podcast. But twice he's gone on there, but he has yet to sit down with the editorial boards of the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the Wall Street Journal. No president in his first term has avoided talking to those 3 entities in their editorial boards. Instead, he's opting for Stern because that's what you're going to get, and you're going to get Bateman, and you know what you're going to get there, and Seth Meyers he's having ice cream with. This is what we're going to see up until election
day. That's true. He got ice cream with Seth Meyers. That was the hard-hitting interview that he did. And obviously this is what they feel he's up for, right? This is what he's able to do at this stage in his life. Interviews, I mean, when that's the preamble, you're the kind of leader that I really love because you've just been fabulous. You're a great father to the country. How creepy is that? Because you're a good father to your family and let's go down the greatest hits. I mean, that's a tongue bath for a president with an approval rating in the 30s, Joe.
Yeah.
I mean, like 30% of people agree with Howard Stern, and so I guess they just want to preach harder to that group?
Yeah, if you wonder, who are the 38 or 37% of people who approve of Joe Biden? Well, yeah, Howard Stern and people like Howard Stern, elitist, basically. Good father to the country. He's been more like an absentee landlord, especially when it comes to the border. And look, if the White House thinks that this strategy is the way to go, they probably saw that CNN poll over the weekend showing Trump leading by 9 points nationally. Remember, Guy, you covered it, I covered it, 2016, 2020. I don't remember any poll showing Donald Trump leading over Hillary Clinton in 2016 or beating Joe Biden in 2020. If he's up 9 nationally now, what does that tell you? I mean, this could be like an electoral landslide. I know that it'll be closer than 9 points, but if he wins all those swing states that he's leading in now, you're looking at like 330, 340 electoral votes.
Joe Concha, we also have a new segment on the show that we call Grandpa Stories. Kick it.
And now time for Grandpa Stories.
Get ready, pal.
So this was on the Howard Stern Show during that interview, Cut 31. This was a tale, a yarn spun by our president.
And I looked at my mom. I said, honey, you haven't said anything. She said, Joey, let me remember. True story. She said, remember when they were desegregating Linfield, the neighborhood, into a 70 homes built at one suburbia? And I told you, and there was a black family moving in, and there was people were down there protesting. I told you not to go down there, and you went down. Remember that? And you got arrested by standing on the porch with a black family.
Right.
And they brought you back, the police. And I said, yeah, Mom, I remember that.
Joe, this is a story that apparently is completely made up. There's no record at all of Joe Biden ever getting arrested with a black family in solidarity. He had said in the 80s that he wasn't really involved in the civil rights movement, didn't march. Now we've got a new story. He's moved on from Uncle Boza getting eaten by cannibals, and now he's like, oh, yeah, I got arrested. I wonder if this arrest is similar to the one he got arrested. He claimed he was arrested with Nelson Mandela or trying to go see Nelson Mandela. That turned out to be a complete fabrication.
Yeah, this story is in my book, and this has been completely debunked, getting arrested on the porch of a black family during the civil rights era. Obviously, if a sitting senator in the United States gets arrested in another country like South Africa, I'm pretty sure it would have made the news at that time. And, of course, that's been debunked as well. The best story he told during Howard, during that interview, was the fact that while he was a lifeguard at a community pool, he saved 6 people from drowning. Was this some sort of like wave pool they had back in the 50s? I mean, community pools, the lifeguards kind of don't do anything because no one's drowning in a pool. If he says he saved 1 kid, maybe I buy it. But 6?
6.
David Hasselhoff of the Elvis era? Who knew?
Maybe he saved Corn Pop 6 times. That's possible. That's my only explanation. Joe Concha, Fox News contributor. You can read his book, Come On, Man. Several of those moments over the weekend. Joe, thanks so much for your time.
All right, Guy. Have a good one, man.
When we come back on the Guy Benson Show, there was another moment in the Howard Stern interview that actually made a little bit of real news, I think. We'll talk about that as soon as we come back on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
It's the happy hour here on the Guy Benson Show. We played a little bit of that Howard Stern interview. Not a lot of substance at all. There were some flubs and screw-ups, of course, because it was Joe Biden. For example, Cut 28.
You were at Syracuse.
I was at Syracuse. It's a good law school.
Right.
But I thought I was going to go to either Cornell or... No, anyway.
Yeah. Cornell or... anyway, moving on. He did go to Syracuse. That's where he got caught, if I'm not mistaken. That was his first plagiarism scandal. He also claimed when he was running for president in the 1980s that he graduated near the top of his class at Syracuse. And he also claimed the 80s when he was running for president the first time, the first of three. He failed the previous two, didn't come close. But that first time he said that he graduated near the top of his class from Syracuse, he did not. He was near the very bottom of his class. He lied all the time about his academic credentials, just like he lied with his plagiarism, then lied with his plagiarizing of a British politician's speech, and actually took elements of that guy's life and incorporated into his false narrative. It's wild. But I think he was struggling to remember certain names of law schools there, including Cornell. Fair enough. Then we got another story, a trip down memory lane from Joe Biden. I guess this is like a continuation of Grandpa's stories. Listen to Cut 29.
I got put in that 10 most eligible bachelor's list.
Because you were a United States Senator, you were a Kennedy.
And a lot of lovely women, but women would send very salacious pictures, and I'd just give them to the Secret Service. I thought somebody would think I was, and I just gave up.
So I guess he was on some eligible bachelor's list, and so women would send salacious pictures to the senator, he says. But he's an upstanding Catholic man, of course, so he would hand them immediately over to Secret Service. Because, as we all know, U.S. senators get Secret Service protection, don't they? That would be another, at least, a bit of a conflation, if not a grandpa story. Then he did the puffing out the chest, I wish I could meet Donald Trump in the schoolyard back in the day, because I'd give him a good licking. Here's Cut 30.
But, like, for example, Trump makes fun of me.
Right.
He was the kind of guy in the neighborhood he wish he could have gotten in the neighborhood, meet head to head. But at any rate.
Yeah. So, I kick his rear end. He loves talking about this. Oh, meet me out back. Like he wants to bring the schoolyard taunts into the actual schoolyard. He sort of fantasizes about this. I have no idea if Donald Trump would be a formidable fighter in a fist fight. I do know that he's pretty tall. He's got a few pounds on Biden, so I'm not sure we want to see anything like that. What we might see, though, is an actual verbal rumble in a debate. There's been some question around whether or not there will be any presidential debates this cycle in this rematch, because the Biden campaign had not been committing to them. Typically, you get three. In 2020, we got two, partially because of the COVID craziness. Would we get any this time? So far, noncommittal responses from the campaign until, apparently, this Q&A, Howard Stern making a little bit of news in what was otherwise a sycophantic interview, Cut 32.
I don't know if you're going to debate your opponent.
I am somewhere. I don't know when. Yeah. I'm happy to debate him.
Happy to debate him. Now, is that a commitment or is that Joe Biden wandering off script where they're going to have to clarify that, well, actually, it's still under consideration. We'll get back to you. I am hopeful that the American public will get a debate between the two leading candidates. Whatever you think of them, I think that's something that the electorate, collectively, we deserve to see that. The Trump campaign says we're game. Of course, they wouldn't do primary debates for strategic reasons. Let's just see how everyone's feeling about the debate prospects a few months from now, especially depending on how the polling looks. Because if someone's significantly ahead, I think it's going to be a close election, there's less incentive to do it, but at least for the moment, it would appear that there's going to be at least one presidential debate if the president wasn't going off script, which he does often. So I wouldn't take that to the bank, but still noteworthy, perhaps newsworthy. The Guy Benson Show returns. It's our happy hour. Keep it right here.
New Talk for a new generation. The Guy Benson Show.
Earlier today on The Guy Benson Show, we welcomed U.S. Senator Steve Daines, Republican of Montana. He is running the NRSC, its chairman this cycle. Really big one for Republicans. We talked to him about how the map is looking, his confidence around these races. Here's part of that conversation. You know, a number of weeks ago, there was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal talking about Dearborn, Michigan, as the capital of jihad in the United States. And you had a bunch of Democrats just jumping out of their skins to condemn the Wall Street Journal and the author of that piece. And we didn't see quite as much condemnation from those people when just weeks later you watched and listened to Death to America chants in the streets of Dearborn, Michigan. And part of the reason why those condemnations weren't forthcoming is because it's not a secret. The Democrats have decided that the pro-Hamas hate rallies and these mobs represent at least some significant portion of their base upon whom they're going to rely to win elections in November. And in the state of Michigan, there's a Senate race where the Democrats are putting someone forward who has been absolutely silent, is my understanding, about some of these hate rallies, even on her own alma mater's campus. A real profile in courage, it would seem, in that state.
You know, Guy, this is a moment as leaders in our country when we need to be outspoken and to have moral clarity on this very important issue. This is the problem the Biden administration has, is that first of all, there's no moral basis to the beliefs right now at the White House. They don't know what to do. That's why you've got Blinken over in the Middle East on one hand, trying to promote a deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which would be a very good thing, but at the same time telling the Israelis what they can and can't do as it relates to securing their nation, protecting themselves from the terrorists, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, and Iran. So they're just spinning out of control in the White House. I just can envision what's going to happen in August when the Democrats have their national convention in Chicago. This is going to be a mess, as you're going to see so many of these anti-Semitics there protesting. Anti-Israel, the hate for Jews, for Israel, will be on full display. The Democrats know this is a huge political problem for them, never mind the moral problem. They know this is a political problem, and that's why in Michigan, you've got a guy like Mike Rogers, the Republican, running for that open seat. And open seats are always easier seats usually to win than having an incumbent in place. Senator Stabenow retired, so Michigan's an open seat. But the Democrats have a problem in their so-called blue wall, which is Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. They know these are very important battleground states for the presidency, but all three are very important battleground states for U.S. Senate. And so when you have Michigan, that race is tied with Mike Rogers at the moment. He was former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, just a wonderful leader. He has moral clarity on Israel. He has moral clarity on condemning anti-Semitism full-throated without stuttering, unlike his opponent. And so when you've got Dearborn, Michigan, they're chanting death to America. When you're seeing the protests erupting around the nation, Mike Rogers has clarity. His opponent doesn't know what to do. They're running for cover because they know they've got a huge political problem on both sides.
Yeah, exactly. So sort of like Alyssa Slotkin is her name, who tries to present herself as a kind of more moderate Democrat. But when the chips are down, she votes with her party, you know, nearly 100% of the time. And with so much at stake, just good and evil when it comes to Israel and Hamas, she'll put out occasional statements, but not in ways that would cause any potential political pain or risk to herself. When leadership is required, she is not showing it. So that's Michigan, roughly tied based on some of the polls that I've seen. You just referenced that. Wisconsin, that place is always tied. Right? The election for the presidency is almost exactly, you know, Trump's up, I think, 1 point on average. It seems like a tougher road there because it's an incumbent running for the Democrats, but not an impossible one at all. For Eric Hovde, who we've had on this program, the Republican, a businessman running there. We also have enjoyed having a Dave McCormick here on the show. He's up against this scion of privilege and political power, Bob Casey, famous last name in Pennsylvania. Polls showing Casey still ahead right now. How are you approaching those races in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania? How winnable are those?
Yeah, well, you said it exactly right. These states are both on the razor edge for the presidency, particularly Wisconsin. Pennsylvania will be as well. This is going to be a plus or minus one or two state perhaps by the time it gets to November at the presidential level. Trump right now is leading in Pennsylvania. Wisconsin's tied. Michigan is leading. But here's what's different for Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania and Eric Hovde in Wisconsin is they both cleared the primary. There's no primary in Pennsylvania for Dave McCormick. That really hurt our efforts back in 22. Dave McCormick has a clear shot, has no primary opponent, so he can stay on the attack and clarifying the difference between himself and Bob Casey. And as you know, Guy, every single Democrat is trying to sound as Republican as they can in some of these states. But the reality is they're voting with Joe Biden 95 to 98% of the time. I mean, who wants to be attached to Joe Biden? This will be the dilemma. It'll be fun to watch, Guy. When Joe Biden's campaigning in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in Wisconsin, I just wonder if those Democrat Senate candidates want to be on the same stage. You know, he has the worst numbers in 70 years. He makes Jimmy Carter look Reagan-esque right now. Biden's numbers are so bad.
So you might see if Biden or Harris show up in a state, you might see some scheduling conflicts perhaps?
Well, you might. I can just imagine they'll have some kind of cutout of Ronald Reagan on the stage or something here at a separate rally where they're far away from Joe Biden. But that's because, you know, the nation, they've got Joe Biden figured out. I mean, truly, Guy, his numbers could hardly get any worse.
My full interview with Steve Daines, NRSC chairman and Montana senator, available online, GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's the whole show on demand for free every day. When we come back the home stretch, producer Christine has a new favorite Republican governor. We'll tell you who she is, where she's from, and why right after this.
Not the same talking points here. The Guy Benson Show.
Home stretch, Guy Benson Show from Charleston. Thanks for listening. GuyBensonShow.com. Our podcast is always free. Well, I saw a story break late last week, and I was off on Friday, and I sent a little message to the team, a text, where I just expected that producer Christine has a new hero in politics. Birds of a feather flock together, and wouldn't you know it, Christine is now a big fangirl of Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota. I'm actually worried that Christine might leave the show to go work for Governor Noem, given how closely they align on a key issue for producer Christine, which is, of course, killing animals. Christine having disposed of her pony as a child, poor Carousel, that we talk about here quite a lot. And now here's Kristi Noem. She rolls in with her new book in which she relays a story about murdering a 14-month-old puppy that she didn't like. And I'm not even exaggerating. It was in the book. She said, oh, the dog wasn't well-behaved and was aggressive, so I went and shot it. And the response from sort of the civilized world has been one of just horror, people recoiling in shock, where you can't blame a puppy for its behavior. That is an owner problem. We've actually talked about this with President Biden and all the dogs that he's gone through, biting people and all that. Then they ship them off, you know, to Amish country or whatever, and then they just get another one and go through the same abusive cycle. Apparently, Kristi Noem had it up to here with this puppy and then just took it out back and ended its life with her gun. And even a lot of people who have been fans of hers and are quite conservative, they're like, nope, we're done here. If you're going to do something like that and then brag about it, I saw Miranda Devine, who we've had on this show a lot, she was saying apparently Noem has been telling this story in private for a long time. And people warned her, this is not going to be popular. If people find out about this, they're not going to like it because people love dogs. People love animals. And I guess she's like, oh, screw that. I'm going to sell some books and I'm not PC, so let's put the dog killing episode in the book. And people have responded quite negatively, I think understandably so. And Miranda Devine saying that she actually tried to make it a more palatable story versus the version that she had told previously in the book, but it's not going well for her. And there's been a massive backlash, and I wonder if this might have significantly harmed her chances of being put on Donald Trump's ticket. Because Trump is not a dog lover himself. He's made that very clear. But he also probably has the sense to understand that bragging about killing a puppy is probably not good politics at the very least. So you might say that Kristi Noem, it's possible that she shot herself in the foot, or shot herself in the puppy more accurately here, by putting this out there by her own design. This is a choice that she made. So amid the chorus of outrage and disgust, one voice has emerged as a staunch defender of Kristi Noem, and of course that voice belongs to producer Christine, who on the planning call today was vociferously defending Noem, unsurprisingly, right? This is very on brand for producer Christine, who was eager to have this segment to defend her new favorite person in the world, really. So I wanted to give her that platform to do so, Christine. Why do you hate dogs this much?
I cannot believe you. I cannot believe you right now. I didn't say I ever hated dogs. I love animals. What I said was I don't.
Asterisk. But go on.
I said I don't think that people actually read like exactly what was wrong with Cricket, the dog, and why she felt the need to do what she had to do. And I
wait,
think,
so hang on. Cricket, the dog name was Cricket. It also started with a C, just like Carousel.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. All right, go on.
So Cricket was a bad girl, just like Corn Pop was a bad dude. And she attacked, like, all of the family animals. Like, she, one by one, would take chickens and crunch them to death, like, with her mouth. And yeah, then
dogs sometimes eat other things. You have to train a dog. You have to figure out how to make a dog behave. That's on the person. That's not on the animal.
Well, I think Christy said when she was trying to train Cricket and when she was trying to restrain Cricket from especially eating the chickens, Cricket would bite her. And then also I think Cricket killed a goat. And then also Cricket jumped out of her truck when she was visiting neighbors. So, like, I think the dog was just completely untrainable.
I'm actually surprised that you haven't become more of a fan of Cricket, given how many animals Cricket allegedly killed before being killed. But I think that you can rehouse or rehome an animal. You can do better training. I think taking a puppy out back and killing it is just not the move. And it's definitely not the move to then kind of like brag about publicly. That's,
well, I think
very strange.
Her point was that like stuff gets messy and it's bad. And especially, you know, when you're a leader and
yep. Killing puppies is messy and bad. I agree with that. But you're defending her. You're saying, this Cricket, you know, Cricket was bad. You're taking Noem's word for it. It seems like Miranda Devine was suggesting that this story was sort of altered a little bit to make it less heinous in the book than the version that she had told previously, like in Private Company. I just feel like if you've got a problem dog, there are multiple other solutions before murder of the puppy. And that might be difficult because I know, you know, what you did. You were what?
I didn't do anything.
Well, you wrote a book. You could have written a book, If I Did It, just like OJ. If I Did It. Many people believe that OJ did it. Many people believe you killed Carousel.
I did not. Carousel went to...
Well, you did. You've been searching for the real killer your whole life. And there's just a mirror in your bathroom, Christine, if you're really looking for... And you know this. I need to guilt trip you or anything like that. I think we all understand what happened here. But Carousel... You said what was like biting you. You'd pretend to be bucked off of Carousel as an excuse, a pretext for murder. I think Kristi Noem might have made up some of these details just like you did with Carousel. I mean, you guys are kind of...
No, there's no comparison.
He's in a pod here.
I was an 8-year-old little girl. Carousel was an aggressive... Nobody should ever have a pony, by the way. Carousel was aggressive, and I didn't like her.
No one should ever have a pony. I mean, that's like...
Kids should not have ponies. Ponies are evil. They're evil. They're iron-footed beasts. What my point was when I told you this story is that... Like,
are you saying that no ponies should be alive?
I didn't say that. Mm. I just said little children, especially little girls...
But if they're evil...
They're not.
Should the world be rid of evil ponies, Christine?
Can somebody help me here?
Justin, I'm so disgusted Dylan. With you right now. This is
she
like,
just like called ponies an iron-footed beast.
All of them. She said they're evil, and while also trying to pretend that she didn't kill hers.
Like, there's no excuse on the planet to shoot dead a 14-month-old puppy. Like, it just makes me so sick. I'm trying to eat dinner, and I'm like, but, also trying to hold my food
but
down.
But like, people all the time get mad. Like, if a dog mauls a kid to death, they put the dog down, right?
But this at least a pound or a shelter. Like, there's other alternatives than shooting it in the head. And again, dogs are products of their environment. They're supposed to be domesticated and treated well.
I think this dog had mental issues.
Well, maybe. I mean, says Christy Noem, but as we saw just now, and you've admitted this in the past, you made up things about Carousel to justify what happened to Carousel.
Okay.
Like you pretended to get bucked off of the pony as an excuse to do what you did, and you say, well, you were only 8 years old. That makes it all the more chilling. At least Christy Noem murdered her puppy as an adult. Imagine starting as a child. I think they say harming animals is sometimes a very worrisome precursor to other things and criminal activity in the future, Christine. I'm rethinking everything.
Did I do something to you today? Is there something we need to talk about? Because
I think it was just the defending puppy murder that you did.
I didn't look at it as murder. I looked at it as like being possibly a responsible parent, dog owner, and neighbor, because this dog obviously had issues.
Well, I do think that there is an opportunity, perhaps, for Governor Noem, though, because we've talked about this a little bit on the show. Have you seen how she's been doing these weird, like, sponsored ads where she got her teeth done, I think, from some dentists in Texas and did an ad for them?
Yeah, so many people go to that dentist.
How is that even allowed for a sitting governor to be, like, selling ads for businesses? Like, well, when I get my teeth whitened, I go to this place. And by the way, it was like, pretty sure in Texas, not even her own state. I saw she did another one in South Dakota in her own state. I wonder if there's some sort of like puppy disposal or puppy killing service that she can now endorse, right? And be like, I used to kill my puppies all by myself, but now I use Tanks Puppy Liquidators just north of Lubbock. You know, call this number and tell them Christy sent you. You know, hashtag ad. She might make some money off of this beyond just the book sales if she now needs to console herself if she's convinced that she won't be on the ticket, which I think it's just, you know, say what you will about puppy murder. It's not good politics.
Guess we won't be booking her anytime soon. Thank you, Guy.
Well, you might. Maybe when I'm out one day, you'll tell me that you have a guest host all lined up. And in fact, the guest host is you. And you've booked Christy Noem for the full 3 hours. Christy Noem and Cookie. Perhaps that's a future ticket. I'm not sure they're going to get elected to anything, including very much dog catcher. My God. The Guy Benson Show back tomorrow here from Charleston, South Carolina. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you then.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in freefall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.